With that, counsel for appellants, please state your name for the record, the party you are representing, and you may begin.
Thank you, members of the court. This is Attorney Anthony Bussa, BUSSA. I represent Attorney Anthony, or sorry, appellant Anthony Limignani, relating to his appeal from his judgment of conviction in this matter. It goes without saying that many of these cases that come before the court, but most notably this one, has incredibly serious consequences, particularly in light of the allegations, the conviction, as well as the sentence that was imposed as a result of the convictions. As stated in our notice of appeal and argued not only in our brief, but in our reply brief as well, there are three main issues as to this appeal. The first issue, which we believe is the most dispositive and the most meaty of the issues for sure before the court, deal with the district court's decision and sort of waffling decision based upon what we've reviewed, based upon the totality of the evidence, not to admit evidence from the appellant related to his negative gonorrhea test in this case and in this unique case. This case dealt with, and as stated not only in the record but also in the briefs, deals with the alleged sexual assault of my client's minor child. One of the main pieces that was used as evidence to convict my client of this case deal with the transmission of gonorrhea to his son. And that transmission of gonorrhea to his son was used to corroborate the allegations, but also to be used by this court, or sorry, by the district court, to impose a double upward departure in this case, essentially sending him to prison for over 40 years. In this case, where there was a variety of testimony from witnesses that dealt with the examination of the minor child, but most notably the examination of the minor child on or about the end of December of 2021 and to the positive gonorrhea test in the very beginning of January of 2022. During this period of,
Mr. Bussa,
yes, yes.
I really appreciate that this is a concerning issue to you and relates to the consequences that were imposed by the district court. But I have some questions about the closure of the courtroom, and
Yes.
I'd ask you to indulge me in redirecting the argument to that particular issue. One of the things that I'm concerned about is I'm having a difficult time reconciling. I mean, there's some issues with respect to the closure of the courtroom and the absence of findings by the district court, but I'm having a difficult time reconciling the objection to closing the courtroom that's pretty detailed at the June 6th hearing and sort of the summary manner in which there was an exchange about closing the courtroom on the July 19th hearing without further elaboration. And I'm hoping that perhaps, I don't know if you were there during this exchange. It doesn't look like it from the transcript, but if there's some additional, can you shed some light on what happened on July, between the objection on June 6th and the decision on July 19th, or the statement no in the record there about the courtroom closure that might help us out here?
Sure. I was not the trial court defense attorney, but based upon my review of the record, I see as follows related to the courtroom closure. It was vehemently objected to as to the reasons for the courtroom closure, as argued by his defense counsel. Judge Askegaard, the trial court judge, made detailed written findings on that. On here, or sorry, made findings. I don't know. I'm not going to say detail because they were not detailed, and I agree with that. But he made findings about why, and he stated on the record about why he's going to not only close the courtroom, but also egregiously allow his mother to sit at counsel table, which I think is also problematic with respect to the courtroom closure and how it looks to a jury. But I think the judge made his decision, and like so often, trial attorneys can do, as I am one myself. Is because a judge made a decision. You don't. I believe that he believed that he logged his objection, And I don't believe he waived it necessarily, and that he just said, okay, I understand what your decision is. So do you want, do you have anything there on that? Because it was a very short, cursory exchange. And then he said, no. And then the court moved on.
I mean, the
So.
other thing that is concerning to me, counsel, and from trying cases and being in that situation in trial, is that when there's sort of a laundry list of things that the district court and the and counsel are talking about, that sometimes they go kind of quickly and the transcript doesn't necessarily match exactly what happened, question for question, or there may have been some exchange there. And I'm just wondering if we need further some further findings by the district court or some evidentiary hearing to determine whether there actually was a waiver. Putting aside the question, putting a pin in the question of whether a defendant can waive that right personally, given that it's a right to a public trial, but what actually happened there? I mean, even your answer is, I think what happened was this, and I don't know that we can necessarily tell from the record. Can you?
And
I'm just wondering if you can shed a little, if you want to comment on that.
I do. That's the problem. I mean, that is the 100% problem. That's what we argue in the brief, is that we do not know. He absolutely objected to it. The court made very limited findings. I believe he violated, I mean, it was violative of the statute, it was violative of the case law and the findings needed to make to close a courtroom over the objection. And I do not believe that that short exchange amounted to a waiver, or that it withdrew an objection. In light of that, in light of the court's decision, because it all is predicated on the colloquy between the court and defense counsel after making a decision while proceeding with the trial. So to me, that's that issue, not only in closing the courtroom for this minor child's testimony, but in conjunction of closing the courtroom, what the judge did is he also allowed the victim's mother to sit at counsel table as a means of the closure. Which to me, that is incredibly improper, and that absolutely highlights this to a jury and kind of brings to a jury, hey, what's going on here? You must believe this kid because his mother's sitting there. And not that I'm saying that his mother did anything inappropriate because we don't know, but it's the optics of the totality of the circumstances. So that's what the issue is on that regard.
But on that issue, Mr. Busa, isn't there a provision in the victim rights statutes that allow alleged victims in a trial like this to have an emotional support person sit with them while they're testifying?
Yes, there is a provision in the statute. Now, when you look at the case law, and I understand the most recent decision of this Court of Appeals dealing with the support dog, dealing with when that's sitting with an alleged victim at the witness stand, an emotional support person, when you look at this, deals with a victim's advocate. It deals with some sort of a neutral party. It should not and does not, in my opinion, deal with the mother of a child who is
Well, the
also
statute
subject to
doesn't prohibit
testimony.
it. The statute
What was
doesn't
that?
say what has to be, does it?
No, you're right. The language of the statute doesn't have to be correct. I don't believe the statute says it must be X, Y, and Z. But with the spirit of the statute and not reading through the Senate minutes on exactly what they meant by that, when you look at this, and you're dealing with the mother of a child who also preceded his testimony and testifying before the jury, that is because they know exactly who this person is. And this person sitting at counsel table, which the optics of it, if you're just an ordinary person sitting at a jury, in a jury box deciding such a crucial case, the optics of that is, wow, we must believe this child because his mother's sitting there, right? I mean, that's how we read it. That's how I would read it as trying cases in that regard. And I do not believe that Mr. Limoniani waived his right to this challenge, or sorry, waived this challenge or withdrew this challenge in any way. He was simply engaging in this quick colloquy about, okay, how are you going to
Can
situate the trial after this judicial order?
I just ask, related to that and also the closure of the courtroom, is there any, and maybe I missed it, is there any indication in the record that counsel or the court advised Mr. Limoniani, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, I hope that I am, of his rights with respect to objection to having an emotional support person at the counsel table or closure of the courtroom, either one of those. Is there any indication of a waiver there?
Thank you.
Legal advisory.
There is none. I mean, if you look at the totality of the transcript, there's nothing dealing with an emotional support person at counsel table. And Mr. Jones, his trial attorney, did a really good job explaining this issue to the judge and about his issue with the mother sitting there. Judge Askergaard didn't believe that that would be an issue, as well as he did not, the judge did not discuss his public right to a trial in making the determination. What the judge did in his order is focus on the statute, but then there was no follow-up about the waiver of a public trial after his decision saying that this specific statute were to apply, which is incredibly problematic. And that's why I believe it's not just a plain error issue because he didn't withdraw it. It's a harmless error issue. I mean, this is not a plain error issue in this case. This is, I mean, I, you know, and by having this courtroom closed and by allowing the mother who had testified in support of her son in this particular case, sitting at counsel table after she testified in front of a jury, I mean, this is not just an emotional support person. This is a mother with an incredibly vested interest who had already testified before the jury sitting there in support in front of a jury only a few feet away.
So,
And that
counsel,
optics.
I have a little bit of a different question also for
Sure.
you. So, there was an objection that was interposed on June 6th to the closure of the courtroom. So, once that happens, once the defense objects to the request from the state is placed to its burden to demonstrate why courtroom closure is required. And I did not see in the record, and I may have missed it, and I'm going to ask Mr. Smith about this as well. I didn't see an offer of proof from the state as to why closure of the courtroom was appropriate. And once, and then the district court made its decision. So when the state did not satisfy its burden, if that is in fact the case, does that mean that the state is now on a going forward basis precluded from supplementing the record if we were to send this back for an evidentiary hearing, a la Fagerus or any of the other Waller type cases, on the propriety of the closure of the courtroom? Do you have an opinion about that?
I do, Your Honor, or sir, because that the state did not make that offer of proof, and I agree with you. And as such, I don't believe, I believe they would be precluded from making that argument by remanding it, and therefore the trial would have to be public, in relation to this issue, because the record was not made at the time, and the objection was levied, and the objection was never withdrawn. So I do believe that they would be precluded from making this offer of proof about why this courtroom should be open as or sorry, why the courtroom should be closed for this child's testimony, and obviously all of the optics around the closure and how the court did it.
Counsel, the state did lay out a number of different options of what could be done, including having support for the child there, having the child testify separately in a different room. So the state laid out a number of different options and ultimately, I think, left it to the district court to decide what it should do. And you argue that this is structural error that requires outright reversal or a new trial, if I recall your brief correctly. But doesn't the case law seem to indicate that really what should happen here, assuming that we agreed with your argument, that really it should be remanded for an evidentiary hearing to allow both parties to fully flesh out the issues and then let the district court decide what it wants to do. And if it decided that it was done appropriately, at least lay out the factual findings so if there's another appeal, we could actually have a record to review. Why wouldn't that be the way to proceed based on the argument that you made?
Sure, because it goes to the kind of error that this caused. It goes to the severity of the error in the district court's findings. Here is not just a decision to close the courtroom for the child's testimony without specifically making those findings under the statute. What it
But isn't that
did.
what you argued in your brief? I thought you were arguing that the district court failed to meet the standard on the U.S. Supreme Court case law and Minnesota Supreme Court case law of making findings, sufficient factual findings.
Yes. However, in making our decision and in or sorry, in making our argument and in making our final postulation for the reversal and a new trial, it goes to the severity of the violation, which would be not only making not those findings, but then allowing his mother to sit at counsel table with a closed courtroom in front of a jury. As the emotional support person, which then gives far more credence to his testimony than say if it was a victim's advocate from the county attorney's office or some sort of victim's advocate from some sort of an organization. That's the problem. And that's in conjunction with the judge's decision. That was his decision in closing the courtroom here. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Were you done, Judge Reyes? I have a question otherwise.
Go ahead, Judge Flaherty.
Maybe I'm not understanding the record, but as I reviewed the matter, there was a motion brought in July or whenever to close the courtroom. There was an objection levied against it. I don't think the court ruled on it at that time, did it? Did it? I thought it deferred ruling on that until trial. And then we get to the day before the alleged victim testifies. From my reading of the record, the judge had apparently forgotten that that issue was still pending. And then the prosecutor prompted him and said, "Judge, what about closure of the courtroom? That motion's pending." The judge made a comment, something to the effect, "Well, that doesn't seem unreasonable," or something. I can't remember his exact words. Doesn't exactly to me sound like a ruling on it. And then he turns to defense counsel and says, and there's no other motions being considered at that time from my review of the record. He turns to defense counsel at that time and says, "Any objection to the closure?" No. I don't really see the record being very confusing on that. And if it is, then it seems like the proper remedy is to remand and clarify that record from everybody's perspective. But it just seems like I'm not sure the judge ever actually ruled on it because it became apparent to him that there's no objection to it. Now, maybe that's not the right procedure. But and we can address that. But I don't think it's just so clear that the judge ever ruled on that objection, and then it became almost a moot issue for him when the defense lawyer said, "No, there's no objection." I don't know. What am I missing in the record here, Mr. Bussa?
I think it, to be honest, given the confusing nature of the record, I think it was conflated with the competency ruling. So there's a large competency, or sorry, there's competency motion, there's competency hearing, and there's findings on competency. And I believe these two issues were conflated with one another, dealing with after determining the child was competent, and then if you look at the record with the competency hearing and the competency decision, you'll see is that now the courtroom closure was kind of intertwined with that, and that's where the confusion lies. And as his defense counsel receiving the court's pretrial orders on competency, along of a variety of other issues that were litigated in advance of trial, you can kind of see the conflated nature of it. And then it was brought forth, okay, well, you haven't officially ruled on this public versus private, or sorry, the public closure of the courtroom, I apologize. And that's when the defense counsel in preparation of trial said, okay, you've already made your decision on the competency and as well as the permission of allowing his mother to be there during his testimony. And then the sort of afterthought was the public closure, which is an issue. So that's where it's conflated. And that's why I don't believe that it was actually ever waived or ever necessarily addressed. And I would agree with you is that if the court does find that the error is not severe enough to warrant just a new trial, it would have to be kicked back to district court to further develop the record. But then the issue would be is what is the state permitted to do on the remand? Can they make an offer of proof now? Can they not make an offer of proof in light of the record, in light of the what they did or did not do, and that's the issue. But we believe the error is so severe because of the mother issue that it should warrant a new trial, not just a remand for findings, but it should warrant a new trial because of this closure issue, because of not following the statute, but as well as allowing the mother to sit there during the testimony, which was part and parcel of the closed courtroom decision. That is our position. Thank you so much. I know I'm way out of time, so I apologize.
Thank you, counsel, and you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes, and we have 15 minutes on the timer. Please state your name for the record, the party you are representing, and you may begin.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. I want to start by making it absolutely clear that there is no confusion or conflation in the record here. The record could not be clearer that the district court understood the issues and the various motions and reserved ruling on the issue of the courtroom closure pending the competency hearing. First of all, I would point the court to the transcript of the June 6, 2023 motion hearing at page, I believe it's page 40 or 39. After a discussion about the issue of courtroom closure, the court specifically says, "I will take it under advisement and get a ruling." And then the district court, following that motion hearing, issues an order on the motions in limine addressed at the hearing. And in that order, at page 3, the court says, "If the court determines that child A is competent to testify, then based on its assessment of child A during the preliminary examination, based on any other information and argument it receives herein, and based on the fact that child A is under 12 years of age, the court will make its determinations of other areas of relief requested in the party's motions in limine, including specifically state's motion number 5, whether to exclude the public from the courtroom during child A's trial testimony on the grounds that such closure is necessary to protect the child and ensure fairness in the trial." Quite frankly, the record could not be clearer
But
that
I
the
think, Mr. Smith, the record is unclear because the district court didn't actually say, "Now I'm ruling on the motion. Here is my ruling, and here's the reasons for my ruling, and here's the Waller factors that I'm going to go through and tell you why I'm ruling this way." There's none of that.
That's correct. There is none of that, but there's
Kind of
none
a problem, don't you think?
I don't think it's a problem because it's perfectly understandable in light of the fact that the appellant in response, the appellant's counsel in response to direct questioning from the district court following at a break in voir dire specifically stated on the record that he had no objection to the courtroom closure.
He did not say that I have no objection to the courtroom closure. Those are not his words, Mr. Smith. And I don't understand how we can reconcile what he actually did say on June 6, which was, "I object to the courtroom closure. My client wants a public trial," with a summary no-no 6 weeks later. I don't know how we reconcile that. I just don't feel like I can tell from the record what really went on there.
I understand your concern, Your Honor. But first of all, the no-no is in response to a very direct question to counsel. Any objection to that, Mr. Jones? And there is no confusion about, there can be no confusion from the record about what the objection, what the that is. And then
Can that though? I mean, because it seems, I mean, just from my own experience in district court, which is what I bring to the table here, things go kind of fast in district court when we're dealing with a lot of things to get the jury going and get the case going. And then it just seems any objection to that is an imprecise question to
well,
that without a definition to what that is.
it might be imprecise if 2 lines earlier the prosecutor hadn't specifically said, "I just want to confirm that the courtroom will be closed for the victim's testimony." And then, lest there be any confusion remaining, the district court just then follows up and summarizes. "I don't remember attending to that in my written order, but I certainly think it's a reasonable request. Mr. Jones indicates that there is no objection." I'm sorry, I have to try and get to this to the next page, on the top of page 261. And if there was any confusion, the defense counsel had every opportunity to clarify, and there was no clarification. "I certainly think it's a reasonable request. Mr. Jones indicates there is no objection, and I will make the appropriate finding as to that. And then on transcript page 476, when the courtroom closure takes place, there again is no further objection. There's no objection that the findings are inadequate. Appellant had every chance to renew his objection that he had withdrawn during voir dire, and he failed to do that. And I understand the record's unclear, but in regards to preserving error, it is the person who asserts error who has the burden of making the record necessary to preserve the error. I would
Can
also
I ask it a different way then? I appreciate the explanation. The right to a public trial is not a right that exclusively belongs to the defendant. You agree with that, right?
I agree, yes.
So how does the defendant or his counsel waive a right that doesn't belong to him?
Well, I think that it's pretty clear that the waiver of the appellant's right to a public trial, it can be waived to the extent that it doesn't provide for appellate relief for a new trial. I think Polzinski demonstrates in spades that that's the case. If a defendant fails to preserve an objection to a courtroom closure, and we're then we now have to apply the plain error test. Remember, Polzinski specifically repudiates the notion that a public closure is a structural error that, when unobjected to, automatically necessitates a new trial. So Polzinski says we have to, if there's an unobjected to error in a courtroom closure, essentially that's a waiver or a forfeiture, and the plain error analysis applies. And in Polzinski, the Supreme Court says the appellant is not able to make out all of the prongs of the plain error analysis, particularly the fairness and integrity of judicial proceedings prong. And so the defendant is not entitled to a new trial on the basis of a courtroom closure. So I think a holding here that the defendant can't waive the public trial right and that he's automatically entitled to a new trial, even if he didn't preserve his objection, it is directly contrary to Polzinski.
Mr. So Smith, what about reversal and remand for an evidentiary hearing? I mean, my concern is there are not any of the findings of fact by the district court, either under Waller or Fagerus. And Fagerus talks about how factors to consider include the minor victim's age, psychological maturity and understanding, the nature of the crime, the desire of the victim, and the interest of the parents and relatives. And further says that the district court must make specific findings. Those findings aren't here. So why shouldn't we be reversing and remanding for an evidentiary hearing based on the case law?
I think the answer is provided by State versus Bashir, which I cited in my brief, where this court held that by failing to object to courtroom closure and by agreeing to a limited closure, a defendant forfeits any error resulting from the absence of a finding supporting the closure. And I think that's quite frankly why this court has to answer the question of whether the defendant has preserved the argument. Because if he hasn't, if he agreed to the closure, which I think is, there may be disagreement. I submit that the record is pretty clear on pages 260 and 261 of the trial transcript that the appellant agreed to the closure. Then he's not even entitled to a remand because he can't complain that the findings are inadequate.
I'm looking at the transcript, and I think even the district court was confused. The prosecutor basically said, I just want to confirm that the courtroom will be closed, though, for the victim's testimony. The court said, I don't recall that request specifically made, but, and then the prosecutor interrupted and said, that was in my motion in limine to have the courtroom closed, and that's under. And then another interruption in the court. So it appears that they're talking over each other, and the court says, but I certainly see that as being a very reasonable request. Any objections to that, Mr. Jones? No, no. Court, all right, so I will make the appropriate, I don't recall specifically. Again, prosecutor talks over, I'm pretty sure it was. Again, the court talks over prosecutor, but there are a lot of things discussed, but you could, and I don't remember attending to that in my written order. So even the district court seems to be, the parties are discussing a lot of different motions in limine that have been brought. The state had brought a number of different options of what the court could do. The district court seems to not recall what exactly was brought. So, I mean, I think even the district court seems to be confused as to what exactly it is granting, because there are several different motions, alternative motions, that the state brought. It's unclear to me as to what exactly the court is actually granting.
Well, I mean, I disagree reading the record as a whole that it's unclear to the district court at pages 260 and 261 what it's granting. It's in response to a direct request by the prosecutor to close the courtroom during the victim's testimony. So I don't think that that's unclear. And can I try and separate out two concepts? The first is the obligation to clearly demonstrate in the record where an error is preserved. The second is what the appropriate remedy is when you've preserved an error to an objection to an alleged courtroom closure. We don't get a second, the appellant doesn't get a second chance to go back and have a hearing to demonstrate how they preserved an error. That's not something that we do. But
Well, why not when the records, if we're not convinced that the objection has been preserved or has been waived one way or the other, we can't tell from the record, or we have some question about it, why shouldn't we send it back for an evidentiary hearing as to what actually happened? I mean, there is a lack of finding here.
Well, I'm first of all, I don't think any party's made an effort to argue that the record doesn't accurately reflect what transpired in the district court, or that there was no opportunity to preserve an error. I'm not aware of any case that where an appellate court has said, we can't tell if an error was preserved. We want the district court to tell us whether the error was preserved.
Well, but there's clear case law from the U.S. Supreme Court and the Minnesota Supreme Court, including the Vagrues case, that says the district court has to provide specific findings. Where are the specific findings for this court to review? I don't know how the district court came to its decision to close the courtroom. Why isn't that alone sufficient reason for us to remand for an evidentiary hearing and for the district court to make findings of fact? And that, putting aside the merits of whether or not it was appropriate or not, I'm at a loss to figure out what's the finding, or what are the findings by the district court justifying the courtroom closure?
Well, I think the findings certainly could have been better. They're on transcript page 476, and the district court's
And what are the specific findings?
the specific finding is that the district court found that the courtroom closure was necessary to protect the legitimate privacy interests of the child victim.
Okay, is that doesn't seem like enough for us to review. I mean, how does that meet the standard under Vagrues of making specific findings? That's a general statement. That's not a specific. Those are not specific findings, and Vagrues lists out the factors that the district court must consider and discuss.
So I want to be clear. I'm not saying if you disagree with me on all of the arguments about error preservation, about the argument about whether the defendant agreed to the courtroom closure, and therefore this court's binding precedent says he can't complain about the inadequacy of the findings that were made. That if you disagree with me on all of those things, I'm not saying that it wouldn't be appropriate to remand for an evidentiary hearing to allow the district court to make the findings related to the courtroom closure. So I want to make that absolutely clear. If I lose all of the error preservation issues, then I think it is appropriate here to remand for an evidentiary hearing.
Can I ask a question about that, counsel? It's the same question that I asked Mr. Bussa, and that is, if an objection was lodged, which does put the state to its burden to demonstrate why it is that courtroom closure is necessary and the least restrictive means, et cetera, and the state did not put in an offer of proof to support the closure of the courtroom, what is the authority that allows the state to supplement the record in order to allow the district court to make those findings at a remanded evidentiary hearing, assuming that we decide that either the district court needs to determine whether the objection was waived or we determine that the objection was not waived?
So I think State versus McRae and Waller clearly say that the remand is to allow the district court to have the evidentiary hearing. Well, the whole point of an evidentiary hearing is to make a record to support to see if the findings can be made. So I think that's the authority. Also, as my time expires, I would point out that appellant has never made the argument, Judge Frisch, that you're making here. I would assert appellant has forfeited it by failing to raise it in either his principal brief or the reply brief. I specifically argued that remand was the appropriate remedy, and he didn't say, he's never argued that the state forfeited its ability to ask for a remand by not making an offer of proof. So I think that that's conclusively waived. An appellant can't make new arguments at oral argument. And if the court's going to seriously entertain that argument, then I think there needs to be supplemental briefing and re-argument on that issue. I see my time has expired. For all these reasons and for all the reasons set forth in my brief, I would ask this court to affirm appellant's convictions.
Mr. Smith, I do have one clarifying question for you. When you were referring to waiver of, that appellant forfeited that issue, what is the specific issue you are saying that appellant forfeited?
That the state is precluded from presenting evidence at an evidentiary hearing to support the findings necessary to justify the closure.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll turn now back to Mr. Bussa. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and the clock is set. You may begin.
Thank you so much. Going back to the closure of the courtroom issue, I really want to have this court take a look at the McRae decision, because the McRae decision, in our opinion, kind of should serve as a guidepost on how this court is to analyze this specific issue on this specific record with these specific facts. Specifically, given the conflation and nature of the record, the lack of any record, as well as the implications of the closure of the courtroom and how the court closed it with the permission, again, of the his mother as the emotional support person to sit at counsel table while he's testifying in a closed courtroom without any access to the public, which includes Mr. Lemuyani's family, was precluded from being in the courtroom as well because it's the public nature. So it's only Mr. Lemuyani and his defense counsel. You have to look at the serious nature of the error and whether it was it a structural error or and our opinion, this is without a doubt structural. You know, should serve for a remand to make an evidentiary hearing on, you know, to have an evidentiary hearing on facts associated with making this decision, but should warrant a new trial based upon the totality of the record and the seriousness of this violation in conjunction with the totality of the evidence in this case. And that is what we argue in our initial brief. As for some of the other issues raised in the brief, and I do just want to touch on those because I believe they're incredibly important. The one that we led with, which we think is incredibly important, deals with my client's inability to present a full, fair, and complete defense with respect to submission of evidence of his negative gonorrhea test. That negative gonorrhea test and the idea of the child contracting gonorrhea is one of the main linchpins for this case. It is one of the main linchpins for the state's corroboration of the evidence in this case.
Counsel, isn't really the linchpin really the testimony from the victim?
Sure, and we understand that testimony of the alleged victims does not need to be corroborated in a criminal sexual conduct case. We understand that.
Right. But in our opinion, that testimony alone is sufficient to sustain a conviction and uphold a conviction, right?
It could. But our opinion is, and what we argue, is the fact that my client cannot bring a defense and the fact that this was used by the district court to essentially give him an upward double departure at sentencing because the Blakely hearing was done in a unitary trial. That's the main issue. So I know the state makes its arguments dealing with the Zabeda case. We make the arguments dealing with the Path case, and we believe Path is on point because here, this was his defense because he had the test based upon the chronology of the timeline. He had his test done as quickly as he could after the child tested positive. And if you look at the record based upon the testimony of the police investigators, they state that, and is that my client only knew of the positive gonorrhea test that day that the child tested positive, and my client was able to get in and take his test as soon as possible thereafter, because it does take time, and that there's no evidence in the record through any of the testimony of police officers, through any of the investigating officers, through any of the medical personnel, that my client, in fact, had sought any sort of treatments anywhere, that he searched for any treatments anywhere. And the only way gonorrhea can be treated and cured is by treatments medically. It cannot be done automatically. So this is a weight issue. This is not an evidentiary relevance issue. It clearly is relevant because the child's test is coming in, the child's symptoms are coming in. The wife, Ms. Schrader, was able to testify she's never contracted it or was involved in it or knew of my client ever having any sort of a sexual transmitted disease or gonorrhea during their relationship period of time. So not allowing this to come in and then argue the weight thereof, it forecloses the defense. It forecloses anything that he can do to defend himself based on these allegations. So I don't quite understand how all this gonorrhea information can come in and come in, and come in, yet the same person, the same provider that tested him and is able to talk about the symptoms, able to talk about what it means, able to be cross-examined on a variety of issues. My client's examination doesn't come in, but everyone else's assertions on this issue get to come in. And that's what doesn't make any sense, because now he's essentially trying a case with one arm tied behind his back with the idea and obviously with the nature of the charge to a jury of 12 people. And that's the issue. And that's why we think it is so weighty and absolutely was an abuse of discretion that should warrant a reversal. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Appreciate the arguments by both, as well as the briefing. It was very well done. So we appreciate that. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.